So the title of the talk is Riding the Waves of Experience. Simi and myself have given a kind of credit to this as a Buddhist teaching, but consciously rather light. This is not an effort to make anyone Buddhist, but to give credit where credit is due, and also to show that this comes from a very big teaching, which is being adapted by ourselves and many other teachers into the needs of the Western modern world. And I have to say that this country doesn't need another religion. Three is already too much. And so to give a little bit of a Buddhist structure to what's been happening up to now, consciously, we have been encouraging working with the body. And this comes from a classic text called the Satipatthana Sutta, which is four foundations of mindfulness. It's saying foundations will be the ground. Where do we go with our mindfulness? Where do we take the awareness? And the first kaya, the body, is the first ground. It doesn't mean that there is a ladder, but it means that this is a really reliable ground for our practice. The second, which we talked about already, is Vedana, is feeling life. The third, which we touched, is Citta. Citta is, you could say, mind, thought, heart. But perhaps one translation in English would be soul, would be the kind of inner neshama, actually. These are all very unclear words, but they would be the kind of inner awareness, heart, mind that is experience, that is receiving experience, that is the center of experience. The fourth foundation is Dharma. And this doesn't mean that there's three practical foundations and the fourth is pure philosophy. It's a foundation of mindfulness, meaning there in the fourth foundation, and I'm not going to go into it now, but the fourth foundation includes the Four Noble Truths, which is a kind of classic Buddhist teaching of in life there is suffering. We suffer because we're stuck with things. We're hanging on to stuff. We're attached. There is freedom if we let go where we're stuck. And there is a path to freedom. That is not a theoretical teaching, because the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta, is about mindfulness of body. So it's mindfulness of the teachings in the moment. So the Four Noble Truths are also practical teaching in the moment. The moment is, where is the suffering? In the moment, where am I stuck? In the moment, where can I let go? In the moment, where is my journey? Where does it take me then? Where do I go from there? So it's all, this is basically the Satipatthana. And it reminds us that the whole thing that we're doing here has an agenda. We may not notice it. We may think, oh, I've just got to sit and stew in all the stuff coming up. But actually, the agenda is liberation. And I want to put it out front. Doesn't mean to say that it's something you have to worry about. But for example, it does help us to understand the difference between knowing for the sake of having more knowledge and having interesting insights, and knowing from the Dharma point of view, which is the knowing that helps us to liberate. So there's an agenda behind the knowing. It's not just knowing, accumulating lots of stuff, knowledge. It's awareness that liberates. And here is where something that which we've been hinting at, but we didn't talk about much. Where is kindness inside the knowing that liberates? And it's right there in the tradition. And one, there's many ways to look at this, and I'll be talking a bit more about it in different ways. But one way to look at it is that the kind of knowing that creates freedom is not an analytical and very male, which I don't like the image male-female too much, but should we say it's more female than male. And then you can forget that image of gender. But in the Pali, it's yoniso manasikara. And it says in the tradition that through that kind of knowing, the Buddha was awakened. And it's more like binata lev, the knowing of the heart. It's the heart knowing rather than a pure conceptual knowing. And it's important. And if you read other teachers all over, they're always talking in that language. Like, it can be different ways, but for example, intuitive awareness or a open awareness or receiving or listening or allowing. And it's about seeing what's under the surface, seeing what's hidden, seeing what's subtle, letting go of analytic summaries, parashanayot, letting go of the tendency to try and make a summary of what's going on and sort of put it in boxes. It's seeing how we build our world. So there's a lot of narratives in the mind of how we build our world. For example, we build so easily the mind of being a victim. And it's almost in the culture, it's all of us. It's so easy to kind of get, and we almost don't notice it. Or the agenda that we have of success and failure, which we have, I'm sure, in the meditations, this comes up in the groups. It's very, you know, in the moment, or it doesn't work for me, this practice, or I can't follow the breath more than three breaths, or wait a minute, where is the judge there? Where is the measuring? Is it real? Or is a habit of mind that thinks so easily in success and failure? And many other habits of mind which we assume and we don't notice because we believe our stories. And the journey is about realization, not reality. Realization is active. Reality is analytic. This is reality. Realization is a process. And that's yoniso manasikara. We're interested in the process of realization, of opening wisdom, of opening the heart. And there is where kindness really sits right in the middle. And it's also very active. The female is the mothering, and it's the mothering that is helping us. For example, very often there's a misunderstanding about mindfulness. And people say, well, I have this issue, and what I have to do, what I'm told mindfulness is what I have to do, which is sit with it. And I hear this again and again, sit with it. So I ask, well, what does it mean, sit with it? And the answer is often, well, just kind of be with it. And it goes around and around and around. And somehow I sit with it, and it's still here after a whole year. Because a more mothering attitude, a kindness attitude, is engagement. It's like what happens in the kitchen. We're getting wonderful food because of a mothering attitude of all the people caring for us here, the cooks and the managers. It's engaged. In other words, if it's a story, not just sit with it, but work with it. See it, how it changes. See it when it moves. See it when it comes and goes. See it where it is in the body. See it when it's not there. See it when it's pleasant. See it when it's unpleasant. See what is not, where it's not. It's really getting your hands in it. It can be, like I say, a belief in a story in our mind. But when we get our hands in it, it begins to be dynamic. We work with it. It's like kneading dough, la louche. It's kind of, you know, it's that. And that's far more yoniso manasikara. This. And kindness is right in there. We see into life with a big heart, and we are kind. We do not set up additional struggle and fights. There's enough of that in the world. And there's no reason to set up more struggle in the name of awakening. There's enough of it already. So kindness in the name of awakening is much, much more helpful. And it brings us close to the world, because struggle creates distance, and kindness creates togetherness. So our big heart will include the world. And that's the journey of liberation, is right there. So I want to raise again the issue of emotional life, because it's certainly coming up for many of you. It's come up in the groups. Simi talked about it this morning. And again, I just want to kind of, because it's part of Citta, the third foundation. And it's because we really need the teaching of how to work with emotional life, because emotional life feels really, really strong. It's sometimes overwhelming. And fear and anxiety and sadness and concern can be really overwhelming. And but it can also work underneath the surface and create a kind of general sense of not peace, an agitation, isheket, and a sense of concern, what will happen, or what might happen, and konanut, concern, what might happen, what I have to do, what I have to get ready for, what I have to predict. It works under the surface, and emotions also leave tracks. They leave traces. So our emotional tone in the day will tend to kind of carry over the next day. And if we have an emotional tone of anxiety, we can find ourselves in that loop, and it works. And the next day is a little bit, it's there still, and so on. So it can color the way we look at ourselves, and it's also connected to many aspects, connected to the body memory. The body has a memory of what is experienced. Emotion that can be right there. And it leads to some of the things that we mentioned earlier also. Neediness, feeling of lack, feeling of something missing, feeling of not enough, feeling of rejection or resistance, tiredness. The hindrances are connected there. Emotions are very strong because they are very close to who we think we are. They're very close to the me. They feel very much owned. They feel very much, they're built. Emotions are really built through everything. Body, memory, self, emotion, hormones, life, defenses, managing, you know, surviving. They're really right in the center of all of that. So they're quite hard to undo and work with. So we have to see how we build emotion and we build our experience. So the first thing to understand is that emotion and citta, thought, are our connection to the world. So emotions are our kind of window into the world. We react emotionally because of triggers happen, and we react. Threatening, we're defensive. Loving, we're open. We react all the time. And indeed, it is a question that came up in one of the groups today. Are my emotions the result of triggers? Or are my emotions the result of something that I'm building inside myself? What's the weight of the triggers? And what's me that I'm developing inside me? So is it the world or is it me? And it's actually not a question that has a clear answer, because what happens is, to be honest, both are together, the world and me, and we are dancing together. The world and me are dancing, and emotions are our music, and we are flowing. There's a partnership between the world and us. There isn't a separation, really. The world is us and we are in the world. But the way we experience it is through emotion and through reaction and through mind. We are receiving the world and reacting and receiving the world and reacting. And we need to actually look at emotions like that, and then it becomes a little clearer. It's not something I have to carry on my small shoulders, all the emotional responses. It's the world and me are together. We're doing it together to each other. And it's kind of a little bit a little bit releasing the sense that we don't have to take emotion too personally. Emotion is our response to the world. It's healthy. It's natural. And what helps us most is that as the triggers change, so our emotions change. As the conditions change, so the reactions change. The responses change. Everything changes. So if we really understand that, then that's our way of working with emotion, to really see it changing. Dynamic, free. Not so difficult. I remember one of my grandchildren when she was six, I think, or something like that, six or seven. So I was there in the house, and the other grandson was angry, and he went off and slammed the door. And my granddaughter was sitting there, kind of happy. I said, "What's the problem?" She said, "We had a row." I said, "But you're quite happy." And she said, "Yes, I know, because I know that he'll get over it in 5 minutes, but he doesn't know it yet." That's so much wisdom from a 6 or 7 year old kid. We can practice seeing the emptiness of emotional responses, because they are not made of stone. They are reactions to the conditions of the world. They are dynamic and free. The Buddha talked about these kind of experiences as like the bubbles on the ground in a rainstorm. So when the rain is coming down, it makes little bubbles on the ground, and they last for 1 second, and boop, they're gone. So the bubbles, that's our experience, actually, if we look at it straight, if we look at it clearly, emotions are bubbles that pass by. And they're not solid. Try and find them. Try and see, do they have a shape? Do they have a color? Do they have a place? Can you define the edges of them and the center of them? Can you see where they go? They're so invisible, they're so fluid, they're so, like thought, but emotions also. So emotions and thoughts, I'm including now emotions and thought because they're so intimately connected, and I mentioned this last night. The thought and emotion are all the time together. Our task is to see that they're flowing like a stream. And we listen to the sound of the water in the stream. We sit by the stream listening to all the music that the water is making. And by the way, there's an American poet that points out that only water with obstacles in it will make sound. So the water has obstacles and it has rocks in. That's our experience. We have rocks, we have problems, we have issues, for sure. And that makes the water sing. Otherwise, we wouldn't hear it. It'd be too pure. So we're not so pure, and we have lots of singing of our feelings and our thoughts. But the mainly is to sit there and watch the stream that passes by like a stream. And see that it's moving and dynamic and empty. It doesn't have solidity. Nothing has solidity. It may come back. So we have to do it again, because habits are strong, especially when they're installed, when they're sort of locked into the self. So the self defines itself as anxious person or angry person, whatever. It's very deep inside the self, so the anger will come out easily again and again. But every time, whatever comes, our task is to see it as basically empty and passing and flowing and free. And the more we do that, the more we feel free. Sometimes we do need, with emotional life, a kind of a handle. The body is, again, very useful. If we don't quite know where to work with an emotion, for example, or a hindrance, we can often work with it, find a place in the body where it appears clearly. And that's just, you know, very simple. If there's fear, we will know that the tummy is contracted. The tummy will tell us there's fear. Because all we need to do is watch the tummy, and the tummy will talk to us and say, yeah, that's a bit tight here, a bit tight there. Now it's moving. Now it's relaxed. Now something else is happening. My tummy is free. And we'll see the movements and so on in any place in the being that we look, we'll see it, but especially in the body. So if we need a handle on these emotions and hindrances, the body is useful. But the point is to keep, and the point of our practice here is to keep noticing that we are bigger than these thoughts and emotions and hindrances. We are bigger than citta, than mind heart. We can hold these experiences, meaning there's something in us that is bigger than them. And that's something that grows as we experience more and more and more. We feel we can hold our experience, and therefore there is a bigger person here that is actually holding in our hands feelings, difficulties, thoughts, issues. So just bear in mind, that's the journey. We are kind of, the journey is to be bigger than, to be able to hold these experiences and watch them come and go. So we get a sense that we're a free person, allowing things to pass through the system. It's a very powerful understanding. We're a free being, allowing things to pass through. We don't shut them down. There's no reason to shut down emotion, to shut down feeling, to shut down thought, to shut down hindrance, tiredness, agitation, neediness. We don't need to shut any of that down. But again and again, see that it's coming and flowing past, and we are still here. Present, witness, allowing and holding our experience. I was watching a film of the Dalai Lama some time back, and it was amazing to watch him. He was being challenged by somebody about the status of women in the Tibetan world. And he's certainly been trying to do something about it, but basically failing. He said, it's too strong for me. I can't undo the tradition. And he burst into tears. And then half a minute later, something else happened, and he was happy as a child. And I was watching. It happened so quickly. Real tears. And then real sunshine. So that's his freedom. It's not that Dalai Lama, he shouldn't feel sadness. And nothing here that we're not encouraging shutting down anything, but we're encouraging us to be a free person, being able to hold our genuine experience as it arises and as it passes by. And at the same time, try not to fix things. I know that is impossible to say because we can't help it. But if there's a tendency to want to fix, it's not a bad thing. Sometimes, yes, we do need to fix something. Sometimes we need to go to the doctor. The Buddha had a doctor. He didn't say, I'm nothing to fix. He had a doctor. He had back pain. (Laughter) it's okay, but the attitude of fixing can help to sustain the problem. We just have to be careful about it. So in an ultimate sense, in a big sense, samsara is not fixable. It's not fixable. I think if you just pay attention a little bit to the history, you will see that there hasn't ever been time without wars. So we're affected right now here, but all over the planet there are wars going on all the time, and there have been all the time, including in the Buddha's time. His whole people were wiped out by a king, a local king, because of some argument, something really stupid. His whole people were wiped out. There was a massacre, Tevah. And people asked the Buddha why you didn't stop it. You stopped other wars. He said, yes, but this one is too strong. Nothing I could do. I couldn't deal with this karma. This was too strong. So I didn't go there. So it's worth knowing that in a way samsara is not fixable, to have that big view. Doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't give with our kind heart where we can, help where we can. It's another subject. I'm not going into it now. But it is an understanding that not to be too under pressure, that we have to fix issues all the time. What we're doing here is fixing a very basic existential level, which is being a free, steady person meeting life. But if we're struggling to try and fix this and fix this and fix this and fix this and fix this, oh God, it's endless. There's no end to it. So the Four Noble Truths also give us a very interesting place to notice where awakening happens. Because the first truth is about suffering and difficulty will be in the nature of being born in a body. When we're not born in a body, no suffering. When we're under the earth, our life is finished, no suffering. As soon as the universe makes us, we got problems. We also have lots of joy. It's not that we only have suffering. Suffering is dukkha and joy is sukha, and the two are there. So we have, that's life. But the second truth is that, as I said, that we tend to get stuck. We tend to be struggling. That's why, by the way, if we're too attached, we're trying to fix things. It's also attachment. So the four attachments are attachment to desire, need, what's through the senses, what we like, what we don't like, what we have to have, attachment to rituals, styles of life, belief systems, attachment to views, believing that they're true, what we think, what we say, believing that our views are, it's attachment to views. They're not views, they're truth. That's an attachment. An attachment to me and the self. But what happens is when we let go of attachments because they, in a way, let go of themselves. We let go, we can let go of things because they anyway pass by. When we just said about emotion as water, it passes by. A thought, we can't even catch it. It's passing by. It's gone before we can look at it. It has, Kaiser, a shelf life of zero. Chaye daf, chaye madaf, shell zero. It just, everything passes by. So actually, if we look carefully, it's already gone. So we don't have to get rid of stuff. We don't have to work like hell to get rid of this and get rid of that and throw this and push it. We just have to be really, really clear how everything goes by itself. And let it go. Sometimes we actually don't let our problems go because we feel, I don't know what I'll be, who I'll be without my problems. I'm scared to be without my problems. I might be a nobody. But so a lot of the freedom comes from allowing things that come and go anyway by themselves. Why do they come and go? Because life comes and goes. Because the triggers are changing every moment. Because the conditions in every moment change. This moment right now, with this word I'm saying, has already gone. And the next moment is already gone. And the next moment now is already gone. So you don't need to think about what happened before. You can forget every word I said. It's gone. Zell, finished. But what's interesting about the third noble truth, and by the way, it's not the truths that are noble, it's truths that make us noble. Again, it's not about truths, it's about working with them as dynamic experiences. So they make us noble. And the third truth, what is interesting about it, is the Buddha didn't talk too much about it. He basically said, if you work with the second truth, that means let go of attachment, the third happens by itself. He really didn't give a lot of promises of what is awakening and how is it, and it's beautiful and amazing and it's beyond the sky and it's fireworks and it's ecstasies and so on. That's not the language. It's like it happens by itself when you let go of attachment. So what is it like? And one way that you can feel it is your word, Simi, Nihitravaya. Yeah, is that the word? It's that sense. Something opens up that feels right. So imagine that we're caught. Say we're caught in a reaction of anger. Someone does something, the world gives us a trigger, we are threatened, and our response is anger. It doesn't last, the person disappears, or something changes, the anger will go. What happens then when the anger has gone? A space opens up of non-anger. And if we really pay attention to the spaces that open up, there is a place of the third noble truth. Spaces where they may not be so interesting, but they're where we are not stuck with the second truth. There's something there that's let go. And a space opens up. May not be so dramatic. It may not be so interesting. It may not have fireworks. But it's a kind of quiet space between things. Between two thoughts. Have a look. What's there? Between two breaths. Have a look. Pause. Small space opens up. It's good enough. Between two things. What's between us here now? So when we look at each other, we just see people. But what's between the people? What's between you and me? What's between? What's holding all of us? And because of the fact that it's not so definable, the insights and the realizations of the third noble truth, they're not really something you can define. Like, you can't really define the space between us here in the room. You can't really define what is connecting us right now. Clearly, you're listening, there's listening, there is eyes, there is seeing, and so on. But there's something that is between, which is not this, and not this, and not this, not this. And it can be quite mysterious and interesting. I wrote a poem in my book because in one of my retreats, I did a lot of personal retreats in Kleel, sitting under a carob tree. And I remember one time I was touched on the shoulder, stroked. And I thought, and I was in meditation, and I said, ah, a Zen master has come to touch me and remind me. And I was in my mind, I said, thank you. Kind of a Zen teacher giving a touch on the shoulder. And then I opened my eyes, and it was the leaf of the carob tree. A young leaf of a carob tree in the breeze was just stroking me. And it's just interesting the way I kind of had an image, but the images would come because there's nothing defined. Anything is possible. Every image is fine. Poetry comes out of that place. And to be in a less defined place is not so scary. We might think we need to know the world, but as we get used to it, we get less frightened of being not in a defined place where we have to know everything and have lots of information. And we can actually find ourselves quite free and released from the pressure of having to know it all. The Buddha was once asked, how do you recognize an enlightened person? And he said, you recognize them because you can't find them. It's a beautiful answer. So the student said to him, well, what does it mean you can't find them? What, they don't exist? Buddha said, no, they exist very much, but there's no language which you can describe them. They don't fit any ordinary language. They don't fit the ordinary mind with its descriptions of reality that we are used to. It's out. And I think you all know that. Somewhere underneath, you know that there's places, even if you try and describe, for example, a subtle emotion that you're not sure what it is. We talked about it, you know, all the time. I feel a little bit like this, a little bit like that, something like this and something like that, but I'm not sure and I can't catch it and I don't know quite how to describe. Yeah, that's our real experience. It's fine not to put a label on things. There are most things we have no labels, are just habits. That's all they are. And not to put labels on things. And it can free us up. And then when we need to put a label, where is Chada Ochel? That's a label. I need my lunch. Okay, we do it. No problem. Or we drive a car. No problem. I need to know where's to stop, what's the difference between a red light and a green light. Okay, it's easy. The mind does it. We don't have to worry about it. But to have the obsession with labels, which we then apply to everything in our experience, is problematic. And as we open the third noble truth, the sense of spaciousness, will give us questions of what really is going on. And that's healthy. That leads to wisdom. And again, I want to go back to the kindness world, the compassion world. And one of the, I'm sure many of you are also inspired, one of the quotes that I really like from Etty Hillerson, and I'm sure many of you have read, but she says in one sentence somewhere, which is so beautiful, and she was really suffering, the you know, Second World War, the Gestapo were out on the street. She was in Amsterdam. She said, I'm really, really suffering. There's so much suffering going on in every house here, and right in the street. But she says, if you give the sadness the space that it asks for, if you allow the sadness, you give space to the sadness, you find yourself back in the stream of life, which is so beautiful. It's like if we give even the sadness, we give it space, it becomes compassion. We find ourselves back in life. If we give emotion the space that it asks for, we find that it connects us to life, because emotion is life. Feelings are life. It's our response to life. It's the way we are with life. It's true that if we have a strong sense of me, a strong sense of me will bring boundaries, gvulot, haganatiyut, defense. That's me. So we will tend not to go to compassion, but to go to anger or to go to defense, push away things. Okay. So compassion and kindness and empathy are togetherness, and where they are, there is a strong sense of shirion, of a boundary, of a protection, of a shield, those feelings will become, tend to be more fear, anxiety, anger, etc., which are emotions of protection. But just know that they are also the emotions of relationship. Anger is an emotion of relationship. We are anger to protect ourselves from something happening. And if we can a little bit let go of the shield, it can become compassion. Underneath anger is love. It may seem weird to say that, but if you actually look at anger, anger is about relationship. But it's relationship which is very dominated by my boundary, by my protection. But if we look underneath it, it's also love. Underneath all emotion is love. And this is where kindness, like we're practicing here in this retreat, helps us to open out, helps us to open to our experience. Kindness is an opening. It's letting go of the shield, letting go of protection, letting go of fear, and saying, I can be with. I can be close to. Forgiveness, for example. Forgiveness, it's something that we can move to. It's in the same territory as kindness. It's saying, I don't have to hold that pain, that anger, that difficulty. I don't have to hold it. I can let that go. I can forgive myself, or I can forgive somebody else. And what happens is it frees us from the past. It frees us from what's holding us, what's in prison. A guilt, anger, regret, something we did, something which stays with us. Forgiveness is like start again, fresh, open. So, kindness, compassion, appreciation are in a way rewriting the scripts of the heart, tasritim. They're rewriting things in a positive way. It goes together with seeing what exists in our heart. It doesn't say that we shouldn't feel the anger that might be there or the fear that might be there because it's against kindness. We can feel the fear, we can feel the anger, we can listen to the water in the stream. That's what my heart is saying. But at the same time, we have the power to say, but wait a minute, I can apply kindness to the situation. Sometimes I get a lot of therapists who say, especially at these times, I'm exhausted. I see so many clients with so much difficulty, and my compassion has dried up. I just feel like my compassionate heart can't cope anymore with 20, 30 clients a week and so much pain and difficulty, and my heart is dried up. So the first thing I say is, yes, but have compassion on your heart that's dried up. That's a trigger for itself for compassion. Have compassion on yourself that you think your heart is dried up. Of course it isn't, but it's a sense. Have compassion right there. So we can rewrite the scripts. We can practice empathy here, closeness, connection. All of that is rewriting our connections to the world. And it goes together with seeing what is. And by the way, the whole of the Dharma has both of them. Seeing what is isn't telling us that we shouldn't develop qualities that are helpful. And developing qualities that are helpful isn't something like the whole of practice is to go back to cheder kosher, and it's all about development of powers. It's also about seeing what is. The two go together all the time. Seeing what is and moving towards a more beneficial place. They always go together. I have to say that if you really meet citta, the heart mind, in all its different colors, they begin to get close together. The heart and the mind stop fighting each other, which is often a problem. My mind says one thing, my heart says something else, and we get torn. My mind says this is a terrible idea, or this is a terrible relationship, and my heart says I want to get married to this person right now. The heart and the mind are constantly struggling one against the other. But the truth is, when they come together, and that's something we can practice here, the heart and the mind talking to each other, intimate with each other, a huge energy is released. We can find ourselves with so much power and potential. So much energy comes from having the heart and the mind talking the same language. You can imagine how it works. The heart is calling us, the mind is aware, and we go out and make change in the world. We can go out and you know, change the world. If the heart and the mind are together in harmony or in sync, we find ourselves really empowered. Because the one thing that takes away our energy is inner conflict. Bits, parts of us fighting the other parts. And that drains our energy. But when they're all talking together in the same language, endless energy. I sometimes joke, I have a history working with companies. It's one of my parnasa for years. I was working with companies in the field of Tzimchei Marpeh. And I used to go to board meetings of scientists and business people and so on. And I used to come in there. I was a bit of a wild, unpredictable kind of person. They knew that. But I used to go in there and say, let's decide that this meeting will be efficient, but friendly. And let's touch the heart of each other, and let's leave this meeting with more energy than we came in. Didn't always work, but if the heart and the mind are together, you will leave even a meeting of the Vadmana Hell or something with more energy than you came in. You will get energy from life. It will not drain you. And I'm sure many of you understand that and know that and feel it. But in the Buddhist language, it's sadha, meaning faith, trust, confidence, where the translation of sadha is to put your heart in, to put your heart in the practice, to put your heart in what you're doing. And it always is, the image of sadha is that it helps you to go to places beyond your usual limits, especially spiritual places where you feel, I don't know, I can't go there. It's beyond what I can imagine. But sadha, that sense of heart, putting the heart there, and suddenly you find that the impossible becomes possible. All of that figures quite a lot in my new book, by the way, which is coming out in a couple of weeks, I think. And it's about me building a house in Clil. It's a story of building my house in Clil. When I came to Clil, I didn't know which side of the hammer to hold. I knew nothing. Which side? How do I bang a nail? I knew nothing. And I had to build my house. And the book is the story of that. But it's all about the heart telling us that we can go beyond the limits that we know. Okay, so thank you. And we'll have a couple of minutes of quiet.